this fourth step. That is, you take it to the church, and again, I think it's important to show that you take it to the church in order to win him. If you take it to the church, and that doesn't work, then the next step is to do what? First is you go to him alone to win him. Take one or two others with you to win him. Take it to the church to win him. What's the fourth one? What's the next step?
Next.
Yeah. Treat him, if he will not hear the church, treat him as you would a pagan or a tax collector. So, let's take a look at that. Treat him as a pagan or tax collector. Okay, first of all, doesn't do much good, does it? I write it for my own benefit. What was the pagans? What's a pagan?
Somebody to be one.
All right, somebody to be one, but when you talk about a pagan,
a non-Jew,
somebody on the outside, somebody that's not part of the covenant community. What do you know about the tax collectors in that day? They were despised. Why were they despised?
Hired
by the Romans. They were looked at as rip-off artists. They were looked at as traitors. They were considered often to be spies for the Romans. So they were traitors to the cause, to traitors to Israel. So when he says you are to treat the person as a pagan, that is somebody outside the covenant community, or you are to treat that person as a tax collector, that is somebody who is a traitor to the cause, what do you think he is saying by that? Well, you know, how he, what does he mean when he says you're to do this?
When this person has forfeited their right to know about confidential matters of the church.
Okay. They forfeited their right to know about the confidential matters of the church. I think what he is saying is that you treat this person as an outsider. And I think he is saying that if you go to this if I go to you one on one in the right attitude, and you don't hear me, we bring one or two witnesses, and you don't hear them, take it to the church, and you don't hear them, that is de facto evidence that you don't know God. It has nothing to do with your doctrine of eternal security. I believe either way you go. I mean, you can believe you can lose it, you can believe you can keep it, but at this point, if you continue in an obstinate way, persisting in a sin that can do damage to that community, you're going to be considered an outsider to the community or a traitor to the community. Okay. Now, in doing that, what do you think Jesus is saying about behavior? That is, in treating them this way, does it mean that I treat them, nasty to them? How would you respond to that?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because
that's why I asked it.
But when Jesus, when we look at the way Jesus himself treated tax collectors,
good.
You know, it's to end the little section there like that. It's hard to really know how to actually treat them, because you treat them as outsiders, and yet Jesus would eat with them and dine with them, things good. Like that. So,
and you get it, by the way, most graphically in Matthew 9 and Matthew 11, the same book, that Jesus eats with them. In fact, the knock on him is he spends his time with tax collectors and sinners. So evidently, he is not saying that what I am to do is to ostracize them. In the Corinthian letter, where Jesus is talking about a man who is cast out, and he says, "Would such a one know not to eat?" He is clearly there, I think, talking about the love feast that they had at the church, which was the basis of their worship. They had the breaking of bread at the beginning of the meal. They had the wine at the end of the meal. In between, they had a meal, and their worship took place around the meal, one of the first of the great potluck suppers. But he is saying, you don't invite them to that, because that is for the family. You don't eat with those people. I don't think he's talking about catching lunch with them. What I think he is saying is that when you deal with these people, no matter what your view of security is, you deal with them as outsiders. You don't say to that person, I really know you're a Christian, I know you went forward in the meeting, and I know you used to be with us. At this point, having gone through this process, you treat them as an outsider. And in the situations in which I've been drawn in, I've met with these people, but I will talk to them as though they don't know God. I'll say to them, what you need is come to personal faith, real personal faith in Jesus Christ. And they will say to me, well, I didn't, I've done that. I don't know. It's evident in the light of what has occurred that you have not really had that relationship. Now, I may be wrong that it's somehow in the divine picture of things, I am called on here to treat this person as a non-Christian. That doesn't mean that I treat them in a shabby fashion, but it does mean I treat them as an outsider to faith. Okay? And the purpose still, I think, that dominates it is that I'm to win them. That I treat the person as a pagan and a tax collector, ultimately to win them, is I want to win anybody into this fellowship. But at this point, too, I think that the congregation is aware of it. The Deuteronomy passage, the people will see this and be afraid. I have a responsibility now to treat this person as a person who has demonstrated by his or her behavior that they don't know God. Okay, when you look at the next passage, I tell you the truth. Whatever you have bound on earth will have been bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will have been loosed in heaven. When he talks about binding and loosing, what is he talking about? Achievements, perhaps. What is he talking about when he talks about binding and loosing in this context? Yeah.
He says not how I would treat them, but how you would treat them. And the listeners who heard Jesus say that would treat tax collectors and pagans in a way that, not to win them, but wouldn't have anything to do with them. I felt you were saying, you treat them how I would treat them, but he's not saying that. He's saying treat them how you would, and they wouldn't have anything to do with them.
Well, except that if you take the context of Matthew, and they were to follow the way Christ treated the tax collector and pagan, that is, in this context of the church, I think they would have said he related to them. That is, I don't think he is saying to a secular Jew, you are to treat, this is how you are to treat them. I think he is talking to people in the context of faith where you have the clear example in Matthew 9 and Matthew 11 of how Jesus dealt with these people. And they would have known, in fact, it's quite interesting that the man who wrote this book is a tax collector. I think they would have had the clear understanding that one of the reasons that the enemies of Jesus wanted to kill him was the way he treated these people, and that they were to do as he did it. Like, they, as Dorothy Sayers said, the three raps on Jesus had to do with the fact that he drank wine. He was called the wine bibber. He didn't keep the Sabbath, and he ran around with the wrong crowd. And she pointed out that in modern, at least in like the religion of 30 years ago, if a Christian drank, didn't keep the Sabbath, and ran around with the wrong crowd, you'd have nothing to do with it. So I think they saw an example in Christ that is the church's relationship, pagans and tax collectors, was not to ostracize them in the sense of hating them. It was, you treated them, you brought them, in fact, Jesus invited them to dinner, which in that culture was a means of showing acceptance. So I think that would be part of what you're dealing with in the life of the church here when he's talking about this.
Let's just go back into that. Like, just say we've got two acceptances, one for the Christian brethren and one for the outside world who we're trying to win.
Sure.
They would just sort of be slipping out of that acceptance into the acceptance of the world.
Yeah, there's a world of difference in the New Testament between the way I relate to other Christians and the way I relate to non-Christians. But it isn't that I have an antagonistic, angry attitude towards non-Christians and a warm, accepting attitude towards the brethren. It is I recognize these people are outside of faith, and I deal with them differently than I deal with the people who are Christian. And that's what I think he's saying.
The underlying motive here would be to
win them.
Win them.
Yeah. In this case now, to win them as we would to faith in Christ. You know, I have to treat them as an outsider. But in this next verse where he says, I tell you the truth, whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will have been loosed in heaven. Who is he talking to, and what in the world does he mean by binding and loosing? Yeah.
It would seem to me that he's reflecting the authority of the decision that has been made in the previous verse.
Good.
That as what has been made on earth will be made in heaven. They have the same authority.
Yeah, you will have, what you do on earth will really confirm what has already been done in heaven. Binding and loosing is probably a proverbial expression. But if you were to press it, to bind would be to do what? What?
Lock it in.
Yeah, to lock it in. To lock whom in? Yeah, the brother who has sinned, if you restore him, you bind him, you lock him in, you bring him in. If you loose him, what are you doing? Yeah, you're saying he's a pagan or a tax collector. So he is saying, whatever decision you make on earth following this process, you will have confirmed what has gone on in heaven. So whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will have been loosed in heaven. He is still talking, as somebody mentioned a few minutes ago, about discipline. Again, I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. What's he talking about? Yes.
I have a question with respect to the will have been bound in heaven.
Yeah.
So if you bind on earth that which has already been bound in heaven.
Yes. That is a perfect, future perfect.
Yes. So it's already happened in heaven, and we're simply agreeing.
Yeah, we are carrying out what heaven has already decided, is the emphasis of that. It isn't as though we make the decision and God says, well, okay, you know, I'll go along with it. We are reflecting. And you can see as he deals with this in these verses, I tell you, if two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. Who are the two? Where did he pick that up? Yes. You know, witnesses, right? Take one or two with you. So he is talking about the witnesses. And then he says, for where two or three come together in my name, two or three who? Witnesses. In my name, there am I with them. Now, it's interesting, if you look at the Greek text, that there are several words here that throw light on this. Look at the word agree. That word comes from, it's a symphono, is used over in Matthew chapter 20, verse 1 and 2. The, within this broad context of Matthew, it's used again. The kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them to his vineyard. Here, the word, the symphono, is a word that is used for agreement in a financial matter, such as a wage dispute, as you have it here in Matthew 20. It's agreement in a legal matter. When people say, you know, if you agree together about something, God will answer your prayer, which that's normally used. When they use the word agree, what do they mean by that? What's the synonym they usually have in mind?
Oneness.
What?
Oneness in spirit.
Yeah, oneness, usually unanimity. We all agree, we're unanimous in spirit. But that's a different Greek word. That's the word homonia, like our word harmony, homonia. This word has to do with agreement in a dispute. So it isn't so much the idea of unanimous, it's that two parties agree. Okay. So if the witnesses, as I think somebody mentioned, as part of the congregation, part of the church, if they agree, then they have agreed in this matter of dispute. Another word that I think is interesting is the word, if they agree about anything, the word that is used there is the word pragmatos, like the word pragmatic. It's an aorist subjunctive from meteo. No, it is not. Forget me. Forget, I think I've asked. It's a noun of pragmatos. It means property. It means business. It is Art and Gingrich, in the lexicon, say it pertains to lawsuits or litigation. Now, what I think is important is when we say, if any two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, usually the way people take that is any old thing. Anything, you know, using the word, like our word, anything. But actually, it is any matter. It is not like our word anything. It's like any matter that is in dispute. So that the word pragmatos has about it the idea of lawsuit, litigation, business, property. It's not anything. It's any matter that's in dispute. Eteo, which is the word for ask, can mean ask. Got to be honest. It can mean ask. But the lexicon says it is usually in the sense of a demand, a formal demand of the witnesses. In verse 5, in verse 20, where two or three come together, that's the word synago, which means brought together, the perfect passive. The word means will have been brought together, rather than gathered. That is, where two or three are gathered together in my name, sort of we assembled on a Wednesday night and it was raining and only a few of us showed up. The force of this is that they will have been gathered. That is, that they are brought together deliberately. So if you want to translate that, you translate it this way. If two or three individuals arrive at an agreement on earth concerning any claim that they may be investigating that's in dispute, it shall be ratified on the part of the Father who is in heaven. So, what he is talking about here is still this matter of restoration of the sinning brother. And he is saying that if the witnesses, as agents of the church, agree about the matter on earth, this claim, this thing they are investigating, it's ratified on the part of the Father who is in heaven. For where two or three are brought together in my name to deal with this kind of a matter, I am in the midst of them. Now, to demonstrate that Jesus is talking about the matter of restoration of the brother, look at verse 21. Peter came to Jesus and he said, Lord, isn't that a wonderful prayer promise? Next time there's only a couple of us together, we'll be able to count on that. Now Peter comes and says to Jesus, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother when he sins against me? So Peter, as the passage goes on, is still talking about the matter of forgiveness and restoration. He's going to bring up another matter. Okay, how often do you go through this thing? How many times do you go out to confront the sinning brother? But he is still talking about the matter at hand. He's not talking about prayer. He's not talking about binding Satan. He is still talking about this matter of the restoration of the sinning brother and how you deal with him. Okay. When you look at all of that, there it is. Let's take a look at that passage again. And if we were to look at the subject of verses 15 to 19, the subject of the first verses that we looked at were the necessity of restoring, or the steps in restoring a sinning brother. But if you're going to look at this in terms of that whole paragraph, what do you think the subject might be? Verses 15 through 20. I'm sorry. No, through 20, just through 20. All right. The method, the difficulty with that, I think, is that it doesn't really take into account the last two verses. I think it takes into account very well the first three, the method or how to do it. But if you have to step back and say, how do I include the next two, what would it be? All right. Okay, let me back off because I'm not being clear. Verses 18, 19, and 20. If the first three verses in that paragraph, starting with verse 15, are dealing with the steps of dealing with a sinning brother, the principle is you keep it as limited as possible. What are verses 18, 19, and 20 doing? What? Right. How to have God's approval. And what he is saying, if you look at that, is that when you deal with the sinning brother, you are acting in the place of God, and you're acting in the presence of Jesus Christ. The place of God, that's verse 18, the presence of Jesus Christ is 19 and 20. That is, when you come together to do this, I am there. Okay, so when you have that, when you do this, you're acting in the presence of God, and you're acting in the place of Jesus Christ. What is it he is doing when he is saying that? About these stages.
In some ways, he's giving us some confidence because the previous section had reminded of an offense to hurt somebody, and there'll be people in the church who would level, this person's not really sinning, they're just having a problem of growth, and therefore he's giving them confidence that when there is a necessity to take this step, they have the authority of God to do so.
All right, the confidence. I think if I were, yes. Okay. And why in this context does he give you that delegating the authority? What is he, you're right, I mean that's what he's doing. But why does he put that in here? What? Well, yeah, to win him. But here he's going to give you the steps, four major steps to take. Okay. Then you got this thing about whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven, that is, you're acting in the presence, in the place of God. For two or three are gathered together, I am there, you're acting in my presence. Why do you think he is bringing that in here? Say it again. Okay. Okay, we're going back to the shepherd. Okay. All right. And if, yes.
You're actually dealing with sin, and I guess behind sin is Satan, so God needs to be involved.
All right. Okay, that God is involved.
But it has something to do with the seriousness of the action and the importance of doing it properly.
Yeah, I think that's, I think you're both onto that. If I were giving, if the subject here, I think, is the importance of the whole thing, is the importance of restoring a sinning Christian correctly. And the complement to that is that when we act to restore a sinning Christian, we act in the place of God, the Father. And in the presence of Jesus Christ. Okay, if the idea then is the idea is that it is important that we restore a sinning brother correctly or properly. Because when we carry out that ministry, we do so in the place of God and in the presence of Jesus Christ. By the way, how does this fit? Just let me put a footnote. How does this fit with the passage back in Deuteronomy?
Community to purge.
All right, but before whom did the judgment in Deuteronomy take place? The priests and who else? The judges and the Lord. Here, before whom does this discipline, this interaction take place? Before the Lord, the Father in Christ, and before the church. Yes.
And does it not come back to Matthew chapter 16? 19 to 20, with the whole exercise of the function of the kingdom, with the binding and the loosing.
Right, and I think what you have in the broader pericope goes back into Matthew 16. That is, here is the what Peter is able to do on the basis of the confession, is to draw people to God or separate those who don't know God. And here you have it picked up again in the binding and the loosing. And that's why I said the binding and loosing is more of a proverbial expression that says you bring in, you exclude. And here it is now, we are finding it applied to those within the fellowship and the sinful context. Very good. You can see how the circles widen as you work with the book. But if this is the idea, then... if you're going to develop this, you know, it is important to restore a sinning Christian correctly, because when you do, you act in the presence of God, I mean, in the place of God, in the presence of Jesus Christ. Without worrying about the text or anything, what would be the first kind of question that would come up if you were going to develop that? You're going to get that idea across. What kind of thing would come to people's minds? All right, how do you do it? Well, what?
How do
Yeah, the one question you would ask is, how do you do this correctly? And it seems to me the principle is to keep the process as limited as possible. You mishandle this, you can do a lot of damage in the church. But it's almost like lancing a boil the wrong way and the poison gets into the stream. You better keep it limited. So, and then you would have your steps. What does that mean? Then, if you have developed that process, if you've developed that process, and with these steps, when you get to the end of that first major movement, what question is raised?
No,
you're going beyond me. I'm still within the passage of 15 to 20. If after you have gone through, you say the process, keep it as limited as possible, these are the stages, what kind of question comes to your mind? All right, when is one. It isn't quite the question Jesus is answering, but you might add that. What other question might come up? Right. Why is it so important to do it this way? So the transition here is, why is it so important that I follow this process this way? And one answer implied is, if you don't, it can do damage to the community. But here, you're acting in the presence, in the place of God, in the presence of Jesus Christ. So the tension answers that question. Okay, let me do something. If some of you, a couple of you, would hand these out for me. Take these. What I tried to do is to put this together in an outline form. The necessity of restoring a sinning brother or sister correctly. And I think if I were adding to the compliment in the light of our discussion, is when we act in the ministry of restoration, we act in the place of God and in the presence of Jesus Christ. I think I would add, in the place of God, presence of Jesus Christ. So the idea, you turn it into a statement, we must restore a sinning Christian correctly. Since in doing so, we act in the place of God and in the presence of Jesus Christ. And that's the idea. Now the question is, how do you unfold it? How do you get it across? Well, the first major movement deals with the process. When we act in restoring a sinning brother, we should keep the matter as limited as possible. If that is a valid principle, it comes out of that. Then we're going to discuss a series of steps that we take that keep the matter limited. The first, we should go to the brother alone to win him. Second, we should take one or two witnesses with us to win him. Third, the witnesses should take the matter to the church. And the sinning brother who refuses restoration must then be regarded as an outsider. And again, under A, we should go to the brother alone to win him. There's two things we're saying. The purpose of going is to win the brother back to the Lord. And the context could come here because of the tremendous problem that sin creates in people's lives. And then, the spirit that we go in is that of the shepherd restoring the wandering sheep. If that doesn't work, if the person won't listen, won't heed what we're saying, then we take one or two witnesses with us. Out of the Deuteronomy passage, we learn that the witnesses should be impartial, and the witnesses should recognize the solemnity of their mission. That is, the Deuteronomy passage is pretty clear that if you go and you're biased, and you don't understand the need for objectivity, you fall in the judgment of God. This is no time to pick sides, to talk about having a backdoor revival. Our purpose in going is to restore this brother. And then the witnesses should take the matter to the church if he won't listen. Why? Because the church is hurt when a brother sins. It's also hurt by an unrepentant attitude. If a person is confronted and they repent and they are restored, the church is benefited. If a person persists in sin, knowing it is sin, having been confronted by sin, the whole church is hurt by that. And now the issue is not particularly the original sin, but this hard-hearted, stubborn refusal to hear what God's saying. The church also wants to win the brother to keep the matter as limited as possible. So you might want to talk about leadership or the way you handle it. You don't want to. There's no value of making it public when it is not public. But then the sinning brother or sister who refuses restoration must then be regarded as an outsider, tax collector and a Gentile. What does that involve? How do we handle it? But these steps, taken in the right attitude, must be taken carefully. Why is it important that we do this the right way? Because when we act in the restoring of a sinning brother or sister, we must take it seriously because we act in the presence of God the Father and of Jesus Christ. And probably the place of God the Father and the presence of Jesus Christ. What the church does on earth as it follows this process ratifies it's already taken place in heaven, where God's representatives, and God the Father and God the Son involve themselves by their authority and presence in this process. Now, what I have done here is given you a broad exegetical outline based on this passage. And before I take a look at the outline, to talk a bit about outlines, do you have any questions about what we have done, why we've done it? It's awfully hard to do it with 105 people, but any questions?
Would we not be also struggling with the question of application as we're preparing this outline? And it would appear to me that the application is being implied in each particular division rather than actually in the conclusion or prior to the conclusion.
Yeah, it's hard not to think in terms of application, no, because it seems so pertinent. In answering your question, though, and I may have referred to this the other day, but I'll do it again. There are two stages in your preparation. One stage is the stage in which you study the text. The other stage is the stage in which you communicate what you have. I think as you're studying, though it's hard to keep them separate, as you're studying, there has to be a wall between these two. If you come to the text in order to get a sermon, that is, if you're letting this influence your study, you will find the tendency is to make the text say what you think will preach well. The danger of trying to study on a Friday night or a Saturday is that you're so pressed up against what you're going to do on Sunday, is that it is very easy for the desire to have something to say that's significant at 11:25 or whenever you preach, that it will pervert your study here. I see that there are really two stages. The first is I study the text and I work with it. There's a certain sense of eureka. I found it. Ah, yeah, I understand that. That's helpful. When I have gotten this and I understand it, then this wall can come down and I ask myself, what's the best way to get this across? I know what my content is. I know my basic idea. I know the development of the idea. But what's the best way to get it across? Then I can look at anything over here and be imaginative. Just the question, how do I get it across? I don't have to put it into a normal, standard kind of form. I can use anything that will work if I can, and my people let me get away with it. But when you do this, there's another eureka, the sense of, oh yeah, that will really go. That's the way to make it go. So I see two stages. The question that you're raising is that often as you're dealing with this kind of a passage over here, you can't keep that wall total. You realize, oh man, I mean, this has all kinds of implications. But generally, you're better to work with the text until you understand the text, so that you don't bring into the text questions that come out of your communication. So the wall is there, but it's not absolutely solid. I find those two stages are very, very important in terms of being honest with the text and then thinking creatively about the audience. Okay. Are there any other questions that you have?
Going back to yesterday about the formulation of your idea.
Yeah.
Where does that fit in with this, the understanding of the text and then the communication of the text?
Okay. At this point, what we have done, what I've tried to work with you in, is what I call the exegetical idea. Exegetical idea is primarily concerned with understanding the text and stating that idea of the text clearly. Okay. When I move over to my communication task, I move over to what you might call the expository idea, and that is to take that idea and relate it to my audience. All I'm concerned about here is what is Matthew getting across to the early readers. Now, sometimes it doesn't take much to say, I can see how that would apply to our people today. And if you wanted to get a third perspective, if you have the exegetical idea is your first idea, that's what the text is about. The second would be your expositional idea. There can be a third idea, which you could call your homiletical idea. I find that working with our students, they have sort of pushed me to this. And this is more of a very very pithy statement. It is finding a way of stating this in a very memorable fashion. If I can do that, then I want to use this. But the expositional idea grows out of the exegetical idea, and the difference between these two is the expositional idea is the exegetical idea as it relates to the audience. Okay. Having gotten that, sometimes I discover for the sake of communication, I can pick up a pithy way of saying this that may not be very clear if I just say it, but it, as the sermon develops, the sermon fills it full of meaning. See? So, in my book, I only deal with these two, the exegetical idea, the homiletical idea. I find working with students, they said, no, actually, when you think about it, we do three things. We move from this to this, but then often as we're preparing the sermon, we try to get a slogan or a way of making it dance. And so if that's the case, then there would be maybe three stages. These two are what I'm doing over here when I ask, how do I communicate to an audience? Yes.
If you get to that problematical idea of 50 statements, does that become your title then?
It could, but it doesn't have to be. It often my title grows out of that in some way because. But what I want to do with a title is simply to create interest. Sometimes I will create interest in a sermon by my introduction that doesn't have a lot. The introduction as such doesn't have a lot to do with the idea. I'm not giving that away in my title. So sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, but it doesn't have a direct relationship. But I want in a title, if I'm going to use a title where people read it before they come, I want to do what they do in a movie marquee. I want to do something that says, I'd like to hear that. And sometimes the nature of a title is it's clever, but it's a bit vague. But all I'm trying to do is get interest. And it's got to be honest. It's how to solve the problem of suffering on a 20-minute message is a little tough. Okay. Yeah.
Just on that subject, the title or the statement, is it? Is it like it's called a proposition or something like that? No?
The title?
Yeah. This pithy statement, you wouldn't regard that as a proposition, would you?
No, not. It is simply a way of trying to sum up this idea so that people will remember it. I was saying to somebody yesterday, a couple of years ago, my son, who's a minister, preached a message on Philippians chapter 2, the kenosis passage, "Let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus, who in the form of God, that thought it not a thing to be robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation." You know that passage. And there's a fragment of an ancient Christian hymn, I think. And then, what he preached on was God. His idea was God takes "Here I am" people and turns them into "There you are" people. That was what he was preaching. And he made it personal. God wants to change you from a "here I am" person to a "there you are" person. If you look at the passage, in the kenosis passage, you have Jesus who is rich, who becomes poor, and goes to the cross in order that we might be saved. And Paul says, "Let this mind be in you, this way of thinking be in you, which is in Christ Jesus." You notice that he then, a paragraph later, talks about Timothy. And he says of Timothy, I don't have anybody like him. He does not think of his own things. He's always thinking of the things of others. Timothy was a "there you are" person. And then the next paragraph deals with Epaphroditus. And Epaphroditus, you remember, brought the letter from the Philippians. Apparently got sick on that 800-mile journey, picked up some germs in Rome or something, got sick. He almost died. And he says of Epaphroditus, he wants to go back to you because he's concerned that you're worried about him. And so he's going to make that trip back, and I'm sending him back with a letter because all he can think about is the pain he's caused you. Epaphroditus was a "there you are" person. So, Jesus Christ is a "there you are" person. And Timothy is a "there you are" person. Not concerned with his own things of others. So is Epaphroditus. So he began the sermon by saying there's really only two types of people in the world. Well, you can divide people into all kinds of groups. The rich, the poor, the famous, and the unknown. People who divide people into two groups and people who don't. I think you can divide people into the "here I am" people or "there you are" people. "Here I am" people are sometimes wallflowers. Walk into a room and they're sort of blending into the wallpaper. They're shy and they're saying inside of them, "Please, somebody look at me." They're here I am people. Here I am. Notice me. Then on the other end of the there you are people. You can have here I am people who are extroverts. They come walking into the room loud and boisterous, and what they're saying, here I am, everybody look at me. Now, there isn't much difference, really, between the introvert and the extrovert in what they're trying to accomplish. But there are people who come walking into your life who say, oh, there you are. They pick you out of the crowd. They make you feel significant. And suddenly, because they have touched you, you're a different person. What God wants to do in your life is to turn you from a here I am person to a there you are person. And he died about it in order to do it. And then he went through his example of Christ, Timothy, Epaphroditus. And then he came back and he closed. I mean, just a we had a dog by the name of Puff. It was a Maltese, all fur, no dog. It was worthless. I mean, it couldn't guard the house. He'd play with robbers. I mean, he was worthless to us that way. But we came home, and we walked in the house. Puff was always there to meet us, barking, jumping up in our lap. He was a there you are dog. We fed him, took care of him, and he got hit with a car, and it was like losing somebody in the family. We buried him out in the backyard. We stood as a family, and we wept. Only thing that dog did was to recognize us. He was a there you are dog, and we wept when he died. We had a cat by name of Pounce. All cats are here I am. Cats. And there's not God has never made it. There you are, cat.
There you go.
Yeah. That cat was around us when we fed him, when we weren't feeding him. He wanted him to pet him. If he didn't want to be pet, he took off. And Tori said, you know, think about it. I don't know what happened to him. I think he wandered off one day and we hardly noticed. You know, here I am, cats. Don't do much for you. And then he turned it in, and, you know, that was several years ago. What is interesting to me is in that church where Tori was, he's now in another church, people in that congregation, when they're talking about somebody who gives out to people, say, you know, he's a there you are person. Real there you are guy. And what he did was to put that into a capsule, and it becomes a way of thinking. So they remember, if you ask them, where did you get that from? I doubt that many people in this church would remember Philippians chapter 2. But it was a way of capturing a principle in a pithy statement. And years later, people are still operating on the basis of that. That's what I would call the homiletical idea. Gets people able to act, because it's a principle that I think captures a dynamic in the Christian life. Yes.
A therapy for a Christian, for a sinning Christian. Your idea then on this layout, I gather, is your exegetical idea.
Yeah. At this point, it's my exegetical idea.
Idea.
No, you use the subject and complement merely to get to that expository, to that exegetical idea. The reason I think it's important to go through subject and complement is that ideas have a way of slipping away from you like a grease pig. And if you don't work through this process, I find that without the process, the statement of an idea often misses it. But if you ask yourself, what's the subject? What's he talking about? Make yourself come to that. What is the major thing or things the person is saying about it? You do that and then combine it into an idea, you're more likely to have hit the target than if you just sort of try to write out an idea. So the process is a way of getting to your exegetical idea. It's also a way of getting at what you're going to preach about. Okay, I'd like you to take a look at this outline for another reason. And that is, We're going to ask you at the end of this week to preach in your groups. And I don't want you to use notes. We teach our students at seminary not to use notes. Why not Australians? You're not quite as smart, but I think you can do it. Devil made me say that. Devil say you say that. I shouldn't have said it. But the secret of doing it without notes is that you have an outline that holds together consistently. It's logical or psychological. So some things about an outline that I'd like to point out to you. One is that every point, Roman numeral, A, Arabic numeral, every point should be a complete sentence and not a phrase. I discover that when you use phrases, you have something like a subject, but you sort of assume the complement, but you may not remember what it is. If you read an outline, you should be able to read it like a lawyer's brief. So every sentence, I mean every point, is stated as a sentence. The second is that no point can be a question. If you think about that, a question may be a way of getting from one point to another. And what we do in an outline like this, it's both a logical outline, but it's also a preaching outline. So what I have in parenthesis is the transition. And you may have a question in your transition, but the point, the statement of the point, is a declarative sentence. Because you can't outline a question. It's the answer to the question that is the point. So let me go through that again. As I am preaching, I may raise a question going from point one to point two. The question might be, but why is it so important that we follow this methodology? Why is it that we have to be careful? The answer to that is that when we do this, we're on sacred business. Now, that's how I'm going to move from point one, Roman numeral one, to Roman numeral two. Okay. So I may use a question, but if I'm going to test the logical consistency of an outline, it has to be a declarative statement. So it's a full sentence, and it's a declarative sentence.
This is the main Roman numeral point, or all of them?
All of them. You cannot have, as a statement of a point, a question. The answer to the question would be your point. A third thing is that A, B, C, and D explain, amplify, whatever word you want to use, Roman numeral 1. And A and B amplify and enlarge Roman numeral 2. Roman numeral 1 and Roman numeral 2 explain or amplify the idea of the sermon. I don't know how many books of outlines of sermons I looked at where, you know, A and B is all, A, C, and D, that's all fine. It relates to one, but when you ask what does one or two relate to, you can't find out. But the major movements of your sermon, one and two, relate back to your idea. And then Arabic one and two relates to A. You ought to be able to read through your outline so that when I read an outline, I read the Roman numeral, and then I look at the A, B, C, and D to see if those four points clearly explain, prove, or apply Roman numeral 1. A good outline will remember itself. A good sermon remembers itself, provided it is logically or psychologically consistent. Yes?
That's a word for a narrative where you're playing a character.
Okay.
Which I find it difficult to have that same kind of outline, especially if you're telling the story. You've got one of them in the, say, Esther, that sermon. How do you construct that kind of outline so you don't have to keep referring to your notes in a way when you're going to act the character.
Let me tackle that this afternoon, because I want you to do one of those. And so you can do it this way, but you put it together more as a dramatist puts together a drama. Let me hit that this afternoon.
Yesterday you said that one of the things about expository preaching is it makes it clear where your authority is coming from. And I wondered when you said that, if you're doing that first person thing, unless you break out of it and then go back and prove it, is that an exception to that rule? Because it's hard to be saying, yeah, when you're being Ben Elias saying, you know, oh, here, you know, you'll
right.
see that in verse 5.
I say in a sense it's an exception. It's also true that if you have done the passage well, there are ways of bringing the passage in. Let me take that this afternoon, because you are onto some good questions, and I will hit it and then come back to it.
Romans 1, 2, and 3 amplify the main idea or the subject.
Say it again. Roman numerals either amplify your subject or your main idea.
Main idea.
Yeah. Yes. Oh. Well, any arrangement of numbers, if I hear your question right, numbers and letters, you know, the standard thing is Roman numeral, letter, number, you know, Arabic number, little a, so forth. Any arrangement that you have is acceptable, provided you stay consistent. If I hear your question correctly. Yeah. And in fact, let me take a minute and tell you what I do and what I think may be behind this. I think you need outline form to measure consistency, but nobody ever hears an outline. All the people hear is a preacher preaching a sermon. So when you have Roman numerals and A's and 1's and 2's, that's for your benefit. But that's not how people hear you when you speak. So when I am working on a sermon, after I've gotten something mapped out, there are a couple of things I need to know. That is, in looking at this, one of the things I'd work with is, what is my purpose in preaching this? What am I trying to accomplish? Okay. The purpose, the idea is like the arrow. The purpose is like the target. The idea is like the train. Purpose is like the destination. Where am I going with this thing? If I were to look at this, I might say my purpose here is to help Christians help people in the church, Christians in my church, to know how to act to restore a sinning Christian. When I'm through, I want to motivate them to do it, and I want them to do it the right way. That's where I'm going with this thing. That's my purpose.
At what point do you start, do you have purpose?
Usually, I get it after I have my passage and work with it. And one of the questions I ask, what's the purpose of the biblical writer? And my purpose needs to be in line with that purpose. It can be a bit different, but it's in line with it. So I usually, as I'm working with the idea and its development, then I have to ask, you know, what am I going to do with this thing? What target do I want to hit? Okay. When I do that, one of the things that I do is to write out quickly a conclusion. I do that for a lot of reasons. One is, the conclusion is where I want to go. The second thing I find is, having worked with thousands of sermons of students and so forth, I find people give a lot of attention to the introduction. And they practice the introduction and the first point and second point, and then their wife gets them to take the garbage out, and they go back and start with the introduction. And they get to the conclusion, and they, you know, they have everybody bow their head and close their eyes so they can sneak off. The conclusions are often not well prepared. In studies in persuasion, the law of primacy and the law of recency dominate persuasion. Primacy, the first thing you talk about, sets up a whole mood. We'll talk about introductions. The law of recency is the last thing you heard, the most recent thing you heard. Those two things will stand out in people's minds if they're worth hearing, okay? And I know if I'm going to get to my conclusion, I mean, that's pay dirt. That's what I'm headed for. So I don't want this thing to sprawl out like the delta of the Bisrain River. I want it to go like a rifle shot. So it's a lot better shot of doing that by writing it. So early on, before I put the whole thing together, I write out a conclusion. I may change it later on. It's just a rough thing, but I sort of where I'm going. Okay, this is where I'm headed. Okay. The next thing I ask myself is, where do I start? In a sermon, where do you start? What? At the beginning. That's right. We've got genius here. It's hard to start in the middle. Although I've heard sermons that I thought started in the middle. Go ahead.
I assume that people are asleep, so my first thing is to grab the
All right,
brain.
Very good. And that's a good assumption. no, any idea that they're sitting on the edge of their seat waiting for you to talk is pure fantasy. I mean, you can believe in a little green men if you believe in that. They're bored, and they have a hunch you're going to make matters worse. What you want to do is to get as close to your audience as possible. Where in the world does this touch them? Okay. How do I start? Where do I begin? If I know where I want to go, and I know where I want to start, and I have an idea developed, then what I have to do is to follow my nose through an outline. People don't hear outlines. In fact, I seldom talk about outlines. I talk about movements in a sermon and moods. It's more like a conversation than it is like a lecture. But as I look at what I have to say, I have to ask myself, all right, given my introduction, that's the first thing I have to say, my first major movement. What's the next thing I got to say? What's the next thing I got to say? What's the next thing? What's the next thing in order to get to that conclusion? For example, just off the top of my head, you have this passage in Matthew 18. I say, well, how do I get close to the audience? What would I do? So I might start by saying, have you ever been badly hurt by someone else's conduct? I suspect if you've lived any length of time, the answer to that is yes. Have you ever been hurt by someone else's conduct and the other person was a Christian? Somebody that you knew, maybe somebody that you respected, and they hurt you. Putting it into Christian terms, they sinned, and you were wounded. That's never happened to you. You either have not been in this church very long, or you make a rhinoceros look thin-skinned. It is part of the human condition that people sin, and we are sinned against. But the question then is, if that's happened to you, what do you do about it? How do you handle it? I know some people, when they are hurt, want to share it with other people. Sometimes you even turn it into a prayer request. Other people need to know you've been hurt. Who hurt you? What do? When you've been wounded, it wasn't accidental. The deacon cheated you in a business deal. A friend you know has betrayed her husband in an adulterous relationship. What do? How do you handle it? Answer to that question is absolutely crucial to your Christian life. If you don't handle it correctly, you can do a great deal of damage to yourself and to other people. Okay? What I would be doing there just would be to get as close to my audience as I could. Create a need. All right, having done that, I said, oh, what's the first thing I got to do? I mean, that's the first major movement. What's the next thing I got to do? What's the next thing? And I just jot it down on a yellow page. That'd be my introduction. That's how I'm going to get this thing started. It's the first thing I've got to say. I've got to somehow say to these people, what I'm going to say to you for the next 30 minutes affects your life. If they don't think it affects their lives, it's over. And I also have to create tension. Because when I get through that introduction, I don't answer questions. I've got to raise the questions. However long it takes me to do that, I've got to do it. Normally, introductions take about 10% of your time. Conclusions about 5%. And I say that because I've gone through hundreds of sermons and measured them. But I haven't given you that, it's a worthless statistic. Because it takes you as much time in your introduction as it takes to get started. To bring this into people's lives and experience. I mean, sometimes you could do it in two sentences. If I could stand up in front of a group of parents and say, I want to give you four principles for raising your children. And I can virtually guarantee you that if you follow these principles, your kids won't go wrong. Two sentences. Everybody whips out their... I can't answer the question, by the way. I scare up more rabbits than I can shoot or something like that. But if I did that, people will take out their pens. They don't need 10% of my sermon. If I do that, and they say, man, you can deliver on that promise, you know, you can write the book. Two sentences would be all I would need. The only problem is most people would, if they were thoughtful, say, hey, you can't deliver on that. And they might be right. So, having said it's 10%, 5%, doesn't help you very much because it takes you as much time as it does to get started. What's the first thing? And my first thing is my introduction. What's the next thing I got to say? Not in terms of an outline, just what's the next major thing I got to cover? My next major movement in a sermon. What's the next? Then, having done that, I may look and say, now, this is really part of this. And when I develop this, I'm going to have to do such and such. Then I will go back and put it into an outline form. The outline is simply a way of trying to capture this. But I'm working with movements and not points. Points are like a lecture. Movements are much more like a conversation. And conversations go through movements. So that's the kind of thinking I do after I've gotten this content together. And then I go back and put it into an outline form to be sure it's logical or logically or psychologically consistent. You have brought outlines with you. And one of the things I would like you to do for Thursday is to have your outlines as you have them, and they may be in marvelous form right now, but if they're not, I would like you to rework them so that they do have clarity to them. Somebody ought to be able to read your outline and get the flow of thought and not have to guess as to what you're talking about. There's nothing that will help you be clear than a good outline developed out of the movement of thought.
And then a number of places, they have an outline, say, printed on the service sheet, or if it's a Bible study, they want it. It sounds as if, from what you're saying, that the outline that we're working from would have to be different to the outline
that you put in the bulletin.
Would that be?
Yeah, and you always have to ask why you put it in the bulletin. If the purpose of your sermon is to explain and to be clear, then what you have in the bulletin would be a broad movement, and that can be helpful. If the purpose of your sermon is to impress something on people, so I don't give a rip whether you remember my outline. In fact, I think it's an exercise in futility. And many times, giving it on the back of your bulletin gets in your way. Because what you may do is lose tension. As I look down, I know where you're going. And once I know where you're going, I just unplug. Last thing I want is for an audience to, well, let me go back. A sermon has tension. Tension is created, if it's done well, in the introduction. It's heightened in the transitions. The place in that sermon where the tension is relaxed, it's gone, the sermon's over. I have heard many sermons where after the introduction, there was no more tension. The person used in his introduction a story that answered questions and didn't raise them. And so he will, you know, give the introduction, and he'll give a story, and the story will say, when you're really committed to something, you give your life to it. And here's a story. Somebody really committed to Jesus Christ, gave his life to it. And then they'll say, now we see this in the Bible. Let's turn to the book of Joshua. There's no tension. You've already told me what you're going to tell me. Oh, why in the world do I give a rip about Joshua? In fact, I don't even doubt that if you committed to something, you give your life to it. See, there's no questions there. So anytime you lose the tension, you've lost the sermon. Many times, it's lost after the introduction. There's no use going on. I mean, you will. You're going to keep talking. But that's when I start. I mean, I can listen to sermons. And you can too. I can listen to sermons if you've been around the, you know, church very long. And I can tell you what the person's going to say. Oh, I may miss an illustration area, but I mean, I can tell you where he's going. If I know where he's going, figure I got other things to do. You know. So anytime you relax tension, sometimes you relax tension by the illustrations you use. If you have an illustration in what would you think of your second movement or second point in your sermon, and it's a strong emotional illustration. You know, it's one of those wing dingers that takes people to the clouds and back. And you do that, you will bring people to an emotional climax. But you got another point. You're into point three. they all dropped out. Unless point three can take them a step higher. But if point three is a bummer, I mean, it's, you know, kind of something you added on, the sermon's over. I mean, people don't listen any further. So your transitions keep increasing tension. There's got to be some new question, some new reason to go on. If you don't have that, it's all over. And as we work on this, you have to have your points. For example, in this sermon, dealt with the method of dealing with people. And by the way, you might easily make that into two sermons. How to do it, and then another sermon, why you should do it. But if you're going to do the whole thing, that transition between Roman numeral 1 and Roman numeral 2 would be crucial. And I'd know I was going to have to take a paragraph to make that go. In establishing a point, a Roman numeral, you know, a major point, you have to have at least three sentences. you cannot establish a point in less than three sentences. I mean, a very absolute sentence, but I've played with this long enough. Sometimes you need more than that. But the ear is not like the eye. So when I want to get what you think of as a Roman numeral across, you know, a major point, you've got to learn to say it and restate it, put it in some other words, and say it again, restate it. You got to do that several times for a person to say, oh, I guess that's the point. So if I were coming out of that first point, you know, having gone through the method, I'd probably say something like, but why should you do it? I mean, this is one way of doing it. But since very few people actually follow this procedure, then why should you be different? Why in the world is this so important? Is it just a bit of good advice? Or is there something more to it? What Jesus is saying here is that when we are involved in this matter of restoration, that is important to God. This passage is often referred to in matter of prayer. Jesus isn't talking about prayer, he's talking about restoration. Because restoration is important to God. The way you restore something, someone, is vital to God. The process is as important as the result. If you and I, as Christians, fail in this, we are failing in the only time I know where God has committed his presence to us, because that's what Jesus is saying. Oh, that's just the point. But I've got to build some bridge where a person says, yeah, well, go ahead. Tell me a bit more. If I haven't done that, if I haven't turned the screw and gotten attention, then the sermon's over. So that transition, I know, is going to have to carry a tremendous amount of weight. I'm going to have to motivate people to listen. It's almost like a new introduction. Okay. So as I'm working on an outline, I know that I can't tell people everything. But sometimes in a sermon, my purpose is clarity, to just give an explanation. And the old formula, tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them what you told them. Works when the purpose is clarity, is explanation. But if I'm going to give that kind of explanation, then in my introduction, I've got to create a need for that. They don't want to know. Then that's even worse. I mean, they got the whole thing in front of them. But if you're dealing with the second functional question, is this really true? Or what difference does this make? Then often putting it in the bulletin gets in your way. Because your purpose is to impress. And part of the power of impression is that you can't anticipate me. If I'm going to do an inductive message, I might as well forget about it if I put it in the bulletin. Because what I'm doing with induction is giving you a piece at a time. And if it's all there, they're home. I mean, you know as well as I do, they've read that whole thing. It's like handing stuff out in a class and saying to the class, now don't read it till I get to it. You know, that's like saying don't breathe until I tell you. I mean, you know they're going to read it. And so you fight it as a professor. You give stuff out when people need it. You don't give it out beforehand. So that's a long answer to your question, but it has to do with the psychology. Yes?
You said earlier,
I think you ought not preach without, you ought not use anything. You can't remember it, how in the world are they supposed to remember it? Yeah. The overhead projector? Yeah, I mean, there are times in which the overhead projector reinforces something. But many times when I watch pastors use an overhead projector, especially then it write out their outline, it's got to be the worst use of an overhead projector if that's what you're... that's not why overhead projectors are used. There is a way in which you can use visuals to reinforce. sometimes a diagram can be of help to people. And you can cover very rapidly with a visual what would be very hard to cover if you were merely talking. But to use it as a standard thing, it seems to me, when you use an overhead, you're primarily trying to explain. You're answering the question, what does this mean? First functional question. An overhead will not impress. It does not move people emotionally. Its major purpose is to explain. And that's not wrong, but that's not... A lot of preaching is done to reinforce and to move.